With its gigantic size and turbulent red spot, Jupiter has commanded the attention of stargazing scientists at least since Galileo first peered at it through a small scope in the early 17th century. Now, with Galileo's namesake spacecraft parked in orbit around the giant planet, space physicist Juan Roederer and many of his colleagues are less interested in the visual aspects of the planet than its huge magnetic field or magnetosphere.
Imagine the sun, especially when it sets, when it's blown up by the atmospheric optical effects, is roughly the size of the inner magnetosphere of Jupiter. Add to that a tail, which would go from this sun-sized object beyond the horizon, and there you would have a picture of the magnetosphere of Jupiter in the sky if you could see it.
Earth's own relatively puny magnetosphere shields us from the solar wind, the charged particles streaming from the sun. And as the solar wind buffets our magnetosphere, drawing it out into a tail behind Earth, it helps create the aurora. Roederer is part of the team of scientists analyzing Galileo's data. And the stream of information is revealing some surprises, including the fact that Jupiter's largest moon, Ganymede, has its own aurora.
That was really not expected. It indicates that Ganymede must have an iron-type core. There are some who say maybe it's ocean, electric currents in the ocean that probably exists under the ice of the surface of Ganymede. But anyway, whatever it is, it has a magnetic field. And that magnetic field, since it sits in the plasma of Jupiter, makes its own magnetosphere. It's a magnetosphere-let, little one, tiny, cute.
However cute, the finding is startling. It's the first moon discovered to have an aurora, and Ganymede's magnetic field suggests it could be geologically active. UCLA's Margaret Kivelson is studying Ganymede's magnetic signature. She says the data Galileo is beaming to Earth promises to further revise our understanding of the solar system and even Earth's own aurora.
We're still trying to understand our own planet's magnetosphere, and I think we're going to learn a lot by studying a very different magnetosphere, different in size, different in its geometrical arrangements, but maybe with the same kind of auroral activity, maybe a very different kind of auroral activity. I think all of that is going to give a lot of new insights into what's going on in Earth's magnetosphere.
Juan Roederer agrees. He compares scientists' access to Galileo's long-term exploration of Jupiter and its moons to a volcanologist who gets to study a second volcano. The comparison, he says, between the two will yield many new secrets. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon. In the early 1920s and 30s, archaeologists sometimes ruthlessly combed St. Lawrence Island searching for evidence of the prehistoric migrations of first peoples into North America. Gary Selinger coordinates the University of Alaska Museum's repatriation programs.
Archaeologists would go into a village and excavate a graveyard, and they had federal permits to authorize them to do so, and the native folks in the village standing there watching had no power to do anything to stop it.
Many of the remains formed the core of UA Museum's archaeological holdings, while others were traded with museums around the world. With the passage of NAGPRA in 1990, American museums have been working to return the pieces, and earlier this month, elders from St. Lawrence received the first remains of nearly 400 individuals from UA Museum. It's also a first for the island. Gerald Sonorek, Sr., is president of Gamble's IRA Council.
It's the beginning of a healing process, where these remains that were taken out a long time ago are finally coming back to rest in their own land.
Now Sonorek hopes other institutions worldwide follow UA's lead. For National Native News, I'm Robert Hannon.
Few people have ever heard of TIAA CREF, but more than 1.4 million people have combined $177 billion to make it the nation's largest mutual fund. Like all funds, CREF, the College Retirement Equities Fund, invests in a wide range of stocks, including $1.5 billion in tobacco companies. That investment has prompted University of Michigan retiree Douglas Kelly to ask fellow investors to join in asking CREF to sell off the stock.
We feel that it is totally inappropriate for the retirement system, which serves college and university educators all over the country, both teachers and staff members, to be investing billions of dollars of their retirement savings in an industry whose products are responsible for the deaths of 450,000 Americans every year.
Kelly argues teachers shouldn't profit from companies that so clearly profit from products that cause cancer. What's more, he says, given the link between cancer and tobacco, investments in such companies is risky. But getting CREF out of the tobacco business isn't easy. A vote 4 years ago garnered 12%. Last year, the issue took 20%. But even if a majority wants to sell, these proposals are only advisory. And Kelly says the battle's political as well, because CREF's invested $1.25 billion in tobacco giant Philip Morris, one of whose directors also holds influential committee positions on the CREF board.
We just feel that it is not appropriate to have someone who is very well paid, undoubtedly, as a director of the Philip Morris Corporation, to also be a director of CREF, which is the largest institutional investor in Philip Morris.
CREF serves 2,300 Alaskan clients. Company spokeswoman Claire Sheehan says the company offers a social choice account for people who want to screen for tobacco, nuclear, and other holdings. As for the others, CREF's goal is to make money, and that's why directors oppose this proposal.
TIA CREF's business is investing participants' retirement funds to maximize those returns within appropriate levels of risk, and we do not buy, sell, or hold stocks for non-financial reasons. We view divestment as nothing more than a symbolic gesture, but not one based on financial reasons.
Sheehan says where money's at stake, CREF has used its weight. During the fight to end apartheid in South Africa, she says the company took a stand and urged other companies to disinvest. She says company directors use their influence in like manner at tobacco companies, though opponent Kelly disputes this, saying CREF has abstained on several shareholder drives that challenge Philip Morris management. To anyone who's watched shareholder battles in Alaska's native corporations, it's no secret company owners can have an influence. And as America's middle class continues to invest heavily in stock market mutual funds, these challenges will become more common. CREF's Alaskan participants should have their proxy ballots by now. Results of the vote are scheduled for November 11th. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
The interview ended up to be really not an interview, but a long tirade on her part. She failed to answer questions from the callers. I think that her anger just really got the best of her.
Fickle Circus Story 3, 2, 1.
Ladies and gentlemen, the new Fickle Circus!
Despite most of their props failing to arrive by showtime, the nine-member New Pickle Circus Company pulled off a remarkable display of the refined skills and good humor that are their signature. Performed to the sax-driven jazz of their own four-piece band, the politically correct Pickles mixed traditional circus acts, minus the animals, with smart humor and artistry akin to that of gymnastics and figure skating. The five men and four women of Pickle worked the Valdez crowd for 3 hours with a range of juggling, balance, and strength routines, all packaged with impromptu humor and theatrics, which kept the audience in awe. Pickle Circus artistic director Tandy Beal says that's the whole idea.
The thing that's most important to me when I'm directing a circus show is to keep a sense of wonder and a sense of fun going all the time, because many people have lost a sense of wonder, and life isn't worth it unless you have that. And the great thing about circus is that it can really enhance the sense of wonder all the way through.
Beal and the Pickle performers accomplished their objective in Valdez by switching gears back and forth from bright lights and slapstick acrobatics to shadows and sensual floor and trapeze routines, many of which seemed almost improvisational. The techniques characterize a modern breed of circus, healthy, happy, and artistic. Beal says many of their balancing and tumbling acts actually have roots in traditional Chinese circus. The difference, she says, is in how the performers adapt them. It's not just a guy balancing on a rope or a stack of chairs that makes an act distinctly pickle.
This is a very creative group of people, and many things come from the performers. Jamie on the Slackwire said he wanted to have a character, and so we talked for a little bit, and then he came up with this character, and he really shaped that a great deal. The guy on the chair, it came out of a sequence, out of a much longer sequence that we were the detectives all the way through, and so it was sort of film noir 30s, and that's how you saw that whole thing come through.
The personalities came through as performers maintained some form of communication with the crowd at all times. The show went on as much with the crowd as for it, reaching everyone and blurring the line between stage and audience. At their best, the Pickles, dressed in baby garb and sucking their thumbs, climbed into the seats, toddling around to great laughter. The Valdez show finished to an ovation as all nine Pickles combined on a characteristic adaptation of a traditional Chinese routine, rolling, diving, jumping, and dancing through and around a set of hoops, punctuating the freewheeling fun they'd showcased all evening. The performance was the first in Alaska in 20 years for the 22-year-old Pickle Circus. Beal says the Pickles will do two more Alaska shows in Anchorage and Homer this week before heading home to California. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Mike Flegel is a longtime hunter and trapper who works for the State Department of Transportation. An Alaska native, Flegel was raised in Manly and has lived in McGrath since 1979. He serves on the Dorion Corporation Board of Directors and the McGrath Native Village Council. Flegel is well known in the McGrath area for his support of subsistence hunting rights and wolf control. Flegel says with no wolf control program in place, the wolf population in the McGrath area has become too large compared with the low numbers of moose in the area. Flegel also opposes Ballot Measure 3, which is a bill prohibiting hunting of wild wolf, wolverine, fox, or lynx the same day a person was airborne, unless the Commissioner of Fish and Game declares a biological emergency and the State Game Board approves. Dick Bishop is executive director of the Alaska Outdoor Council. Bishop was happy to hear of Mike Flegel's appointment to the Game Board.
Yeah, I was very pleased to see that. I think he'll do a good job. I think he's a very capable and articulate person, and definitely is a broad-minded person who will recognize and respect others' values.
Bishop and Flegel have been in the forefront of the debate over wolf control.
We work together on the meeting that was held in McGrath regarding the wolf control program there when the governor came out, and in taping a panel debate on the ballot measure 3 issue. And I found Mike very good to work with, and of course we were on the same side of the issue, so that really helped. We both opposed the ballot measure 3. So we had a lot in common, and not much to argue about on that.
Dick Bishop, Executive Director of the Alaska Outdoor Council. Cindy Lowry, Executive Director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, was also part of the panel which included Dick Bishop and Mike Flegel that debated wolf control in Juneau recently. She says the Wildlife Alliance and Mike Flegel don't appear to agree on many issues.
Well, we're not, in agreement as far as the aerial wolf control needs to be conducted this winter, and I think there's a lot of information that's lacking to know whether it's wolves or bears or, a number of factors. As far as his appointment to the Board of Game, I guess our only concern was that, not only just with his appointment, but the other person as well, that there now is not a single person on the Board of Game that represents non-consumptive use interests.
Lowry says she'll wait and see if Flegel is open to the Wildlife Alliance's point of view.
Well, we've tried, working together so far in Juneau, and there's the dialogue has started, so I think, at least from my perspective, we're trying to have some dialogue.
Cindy Lowry, Executive Director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. The board next meets in Sitka on October 25th through the 31st. Mike Flegel and Greg Streveler will serve on the State Game Board pending confirmation of their appointments by the legislature next year. In McGrath, I'm Scott Stevens.
During the debate, Don Young played up his clout in Washington as chair of the House Resources Committee and pointed to his partnership with fellow Republican senators Frank Murkowski and Ted Stevens. Young took the opportunity to list his accomplishments, including among them the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the Magnuson Fisheries Act. He warned about the dangers to Alaska should Clinton be reelected and predicted far from losing seats in the House, Republicans would win big on November 5th.
We're going to pick up 20 seats in the House. Don't ever kid yourself. Election night, you watch that. I'll be there on television telling you I told you so. I haven't given up on Bob Dole.
Indeed, Young says Dole's 15% tax cut plan would give a big boost to the economy. Both candidates promote opening ANWR, but Georgiana Lincoln says she wants securities for the environment and wildlife before backing any development plans. Lincoln also took aim at Young's combative style, saying she's a compassionate consensus builder. She says while she wouldn't rubber stamp every bill presented by President Clinton, she would enjoy a closer working relationship with the administration than Young. Lincoln has attacked Young for failing in his chairmanship to ensure ANWR and Tonga's timber legislation were enacted.
I hear the administration, the Clinton administration is holding us back from all of these things. Well, if that's so, then we do need somebody back there that can help to move our agenda forward.
Lincoln also accused Young of moving $25 million out of Alaska's rural programs to subsidize tobacco growers, an industry from which he has received substantial campaign contributions. Both candidates say they support education and keeping graduates in Alaska with more jobs. And both took aim at national parks, claiming park administrators favor outsiders for posts. The forum lasted about an hour. Other candidates for the lone U.S. House seat were not invited to the exchange. Young and Lincoln taped another debate last week for television. It airs on Alaska One this evening at 8. That's followed at 9 by another debate between candidates Ted Stevens and Teresa Obermeyer for the U.S. Senate race. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
It's a sunny winter's day. The air is crisp and cold. Conditions are perfect for snow machining. A snow machiner from Fairbanks decides to head for Chattanooga and the more than 75 miles of groomed trails there. But to get to them, he'll cross private property and use roads and power line trails right next to homes. Sam Berger runs a snow machine rental business out of the Chattanooga Lodge on the Stees Highway north of Fairbanks. He and his neighbors have invested thousands of dollars into maintaining and marking the four multi-use trails in the area. Berger says a Trans-Alaska Trail is a good goal, but local access needs to be addressed first.
It's a lot of footwork, finding a route and getting permission for that route so that it's a multi-use corridor between Fairbanks and all of the riding areas north of town. And this is probably true toward the North Pole area east and toward Nenana to the west. But it's certainly true north of town. We have lots and lots of snowmobilers that ride out from town. It's a great day trip. But in a lot of cases, they're either trespassing or using the roads illegally to get here.
State Parks planner Ron Crenshaw agrees with Berger. He says the $15,000 federal grant, matched by state funds, will focus on a snow machine trail from Fairbanks to Nenana. He's not even sure if a marked trail will be the result of the grant, but the division has hired Scott Hydorn from the University of Alaska Fairbanks to find the best route with access to the highway and roadhouses. Crenshaw says up until now, snow machine use in Alaska has largely been ignored.
The bottom line is there are, you know, many, many thousands of snowmobiles in Alaska. There's an enormous amount of money spent on buying, operating, and registering those vehicles, and very little of that money is going back into providing riding opportunities for them, whether it be going to work or going to hunt or for subsistence use or for just pure recreation. The need is the same.
And Crenshaw says this trail is just the first step in the state's plans to link the railway by trailway.
We're looking at a recreational corridor for snowmobiles through the rail belt north to south to pick up Fairbanks, Riders, Nenana, the Matsu Valley, Anchorage, and maybe on down to the Kenai Peninsula ultimately. This is sort of viewed as a pilot project to figure out how to get this done since it hasn't been done in the state before.
Crenshaw calls the proposed corridor an investment in outdoor recreation. He says it could eventually be used year-round. Planners have visions of snow machines, dog mushers, and skiers using the trail in the winter, while hikers, bikers, and horseback riders traverse it in the summer months. But Crenshaw says this initial spending is only seed money. If the state really wants the railway corridor trail, it's going to have to pay for it. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
District 30 incumbent Tom Brice is crying foul over ads his opponent aired on television. I'm Robert Hannon. Brice fired off press releases Thursday, claiming Republican challenger Bob Boko knowingly distorted Brice's voting record. Brice says the ads claim he voted against a university land bill and another piece of anti-crime legislation. Brice points to the record showing his support for both bills and says he's saddened by Boko stooping to such tactics.
I was very pleased to hear Mr. Boko say, you know, after the primary that he's looking forward to a clean campaign. Now he's gone into misleading or providing the public with very misleading information as well as out-and-out untruths. Lies, basically.
Brice says he's already cut response ads, setting the record straight. For his part, Boko says the ads were a mistake, not because they were wrong in content, but wrong in tone.
When my people brought that ad to me, I said, okay, let's run it for, run it for about 3 or 4 days. And then I started looking at it, and I had a number of my other friends around and said, you know, Bob, that's not you. So what I did, I pulled it yesterday.
Boko doesn't dispute that when both bills first came up for vote, Brice supported them. But after the governor vetoed them, Brice backed him by not voting to override the vetoes. To Boko's way of thinking, that's politically dishonest, and he, too, points to the House voting record to support his views. Both candidates would close the budget gap by taxing tobacco products. Boko would like to see those revenues fund smoking prevention programs. And both candidates would also reduce state government. Brice is for more gradual reductions, while Boko backs his party's 5-year plan to cut $250 million. But he says he can't give specifics until he gets to Juneau. While Boko won't go so far as to say he'd buck his own party, he does say he's a candidate who isn't afraid to stand alone.
You can see this by the way I vote on the school board. I stand alone there, but I stand alone because people tell me where, and then a lot of people tell me where they stand on a specific topic that comes up, and I stand alone there. And I probably will be standing alone sometimes in the legislature because I'll be voting with what the people in my particular area, if it affects them, feel is important to them.
Still smarting from Boko's ads, Brice, on the other hand, says his integrity in office will give voters a clear choice come election day.
For the past 4 years, I've done my best to ensure that me and my office deal with the public on issues in an honest, straightforward fashion. And I don't think that this type of campaigning really has any place in the election process that we're facing now.
At roughly $23,000, Boko is running behind Brice in fundraising. Most of his big money comes from Republican Party groups. For Brice, who's raised nearly $50,000, large donors include ARCO, the National Education Association, and Fairbanks Central Labor. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
It's $455,000 over 3 years. Designed as a demonstration project, the first year's budget of over $200,000 will triple the size of the Sunshine Clinic's operation and bring on board a new physician's assistant, a mental health worker, a family support worker, and an administrator for the tiny clinic, which has been struggling with only one medical provider, several volunteers, and a tiny support staff. Jessica Stevens, the clinic director and the physician assistant, has been seeing patients and administering the clinic. She wrote the grant and was surprised when she heard it was awarded.
We were told, there was no money for New Start programs, that we didn't have a chance, and so I was pretty shocked when we actually were informed that we had received it, and was you know, really overwhelmed at the task in hand, as well as pretty excited.
Stevens hopes that as the staff changes the nature of the operation in order to manage what is a major federal grant, the only thing that patients will notice in the next year is better services and less chaos at the office. But she has no illusions. It's going to be a tough and challenging year. She plans to have all the new staff in place by January.
So all this would be would allow us to see people in a more timely fashion and more, you know, be able to offer more services. And the person that we're hoping to hire is certainly very, very skilled and, you know, has lots of experience and I think will be a really good complement to the other healthcare services in the community.
One of the major components of the grant is a family health provider. The goal is to help families before they get into trouble by starting with prenatal care and working on substance abuse issues early enough to help make healthy babies, and following up with nutritional counseling to conventional family counseling, designed to both make healthy bodies and home environments.
That's exactly right, and it's always been a great interest of mine. You know, I see the kind of medicine that I practice for the most part as Band-Aid medicine, and I really don't like it, but I like the contact I have with people because it enables me to see how people can make change and how we can all make change, and see healthcare as a real way of people making change. And it's not just the narrow, you know, that you have a cold and therefore you know, you do this, that and the other, but just how we live, how we eat, how we exercise, how we relate to people. I mean, I see all those as issues of health, and I think that the goal of this grant was really to put some things in place about health rather than illness.
Part of the challenge facing the Sunshine Clinic is going to be documenting the effectiveness of these strategies. Not only do the programs require more paperwork, but with good statistics, Stevens hopes to build a case for prevention as an effective strategy for rural health providers. In Talkeetna, I'm Johanna Urich.
The candidates running in District 36, incumbent Democrat Irene Nicolai and her challenger, Republican Carl Morgan, spent little money on the traditional media outlets, radio, television, and newspapers. Instead, they campaign by air. Chartering small planes is an expensive way to travel. Irene Nicolai says most of her flights have been provided by various charter flight services who support her campaign. She's also received contributions from Doyon Limited, the Small Pack and Ice Block Native Regional Corporations, seafood companies, and a group of attorneys in Bethel. And as the campaign has hit the final stretch, traditional Democratic supporters, including the Teamsters Union, have contributed close to $7,000 to the Democrats' campaign. Aside from the campaign funds provided by the state Republican committee, Republican challenger Carl Morgan has relied on contributions from individuals rather than organizations. Carl Morgan was born in Upper Kalfskag and now lives in Aniak. He's an electrician and has been mayor of Aniak for the past 4 months. Both candidates have at least one issue they both agree on, subsistence hunting and fishing rights. Morgan says it would be political suicide for him to oppose subsistence priority use of fish and game, and has already informed the Republican leadership of his position. As far as other issues, Morgan says he and Nicolai are not on opposite ends of a political spectrum.
I think the differences are not that far apart. It's just, I believe in the government. We should streamline the government. Biggest issue that I see out there that District 36 is concerned about is we must, at all costs, save and preserve the protect the subsistence issue.
Besides cutting what he sees as wasteful programs and trimming the state budget, Morgan says being part of the Republican majority in the state House will allow him a greater say in allocation of state funds to District 36.
When elected, we'll be in the majority. We'll have a strong voice. I will be in the majority. It's always better to be in the majority than in the minority. It's better to be in there with the boys or the women, making the decisions and making them listen to our concerns and our differences from the Bush.
Republican Carl Morgan. The incumbent Democrat, Irene Nicolai, was born in Tanana and resides there. She was first elected to the State House in 1992. She says being in the minority party in the state house requires a different strategy than being in the majority.
I think it was more like fighting bad bills than passing good bills, actually. There's a lot of bad bills for rural Alaska.
Nikolai says she's trying to hold the line against any further cuts to programs that would benefit rural Alaskans. She also says her Republican challenger is mistaken in his notion that being part of the majority party will allow him to bring in more state funds to House District 36. She says due to cuts in the state's budget, the only capital funds available will come from fellow Democrat Governor Tony Knowles. Nikolai says Morgan doesn't know how the political game is played in Juneau.
He doesn't have the experience either. He doesn't realize how tough it is down there, that when you go down there, you're only one vote. And it's not what party you belong to, but it's what you can do as a person. It's a power of speech.
House District 36 Democrat incumbent Irene Nikolai. Both candidates plan to keep up their nonstop traveling and campaigning right up to Election Day, next Tuesday, November 5th. Reporting from McGrath, I'm Scott Stevens.
Since 1989, spruce bark beetles have killed trees on over 600,000 acres within the Copper River Valley. As the infestation increases to historic proportions, land managers are scrambling to understand a plight which has similarly affected other areas of the state, particularly the Kenai Peninsula.
Because we're really not too sure exactly how things are going to come back, if they're going to follow the pattern we've seen on the Kenai, where Cal McGrath just the grass becomes an important part of the post-infestation vegetation, or if alder is going to be the big thing coming back.
Karen Oakley is managing a $180,000 U.S. Geological Survey grant aimed at answering such questions. She organized a conference recently which brought together federal, state, and private landholders to discuss the beetle situation in the Copper Basin. Oakley says the concerns expressed vary with the land manager.
We expect questions related to effects on wildlife, kind of like what will things look like in 10, 20, or 50 years, and also questions related to what will come back on the areas that have been logged.
Oakley is currently assessing needs of affected property holders, planning research for some, and directing others to existing studies done on the Kenai. With so many unknowns, the only thing that's for sure is that it will be some time before a healthy spruce forest exists again in the beetle-devastated areas. Trish Wirtz is an ecologist with the Forest Service and specializes in spruce regeneration.
It could take hundreds and hundreds of years for spruce to recolonize a site. But in the best case, that is when not all the trees are killed or there's a good understory of spruce seedlings, it could take only 30 or 50 years before there's a good healthy stand of spruce there again.
Wirtz says the beetles are a natural part of the ecosystem and that it's unclear what role human practices like logging and fire control have played in their spread in the Copper Valley. She says there are basically three approaches once beetles have killed trees in an area.
Do nothing at all. Harvest trees but make no special efforts at regeneration, and then also to harvest trees but make some effort at regeneration. If you have any live mature trees left on your land, leave some of them standing with the hope that they'll survive the infestation and drop some seed on your site. You can also time your harvesting or use harvesting methods so it tears up the soil surface to provide a good seed bed for the seeds.
Wirtz favors replanting as an effective tool for reforesting areas which otherwise might take over a century to do so on their own. But for most private landowners, timber values just don't stack up to the cost. The Glen Allen-based Otna Regional Native Corporation has some 500,000 acres of timber holdings in the Copper Basin. Chief Forester Al Yates says the beetles, coupled with the aging state of much of the spruce and a volatile export market for pulp, have left the corporation salvaging an average of just $200 per acre from its timber. Yates echoes a plea often expressed by timber holders for an in-state value-added market for wood, but timber aside, isn't worried about the beetles' effect on the integrity of the forest ecosystem.
What it will change, too, is another natural Alaskan type of landscape. We may lose habitat for pine marten. We will gain habitat for moose. Who's to balance the value of one against the other?
In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
One's a moderate Republican, the other's a moderate Democrat. I'm Teresa Bacher. In the race to represent residents of Districts 29 and 30, Gary Wilkin and David Guttenberg haven't found many ideas which divide them. Guttenberg says that worries him because it means the campaign isn't high profile, but he is pleased it hasn't turned to smear tactics. Guttenberg points to attitudes about local hire as an example of how the two differ.
It's not just supporting local hire. It's understanding that there are literally hundreds of jobs that used to be filled by people in Fairbanks that are now filled by people in Anchorage. I've been involved in that for 10 years. If you want to get down to the nitty-gritty of it, the chamber hasn't minded those jobs going because they were union jobs. Now, if you want a strong economy, you bring the jobs back regardless of whether they're union or not.
Guttenberg says people in Fairbanks need opportunities here, while Wilkin says local hire and Alaska hire are the same thing.
We have to concentrate certainly on Alaska hire. Obviously, I would like to have the people I represent, District 29, working. But I think we really run into problems if we start to restrict it down to neighborhoods who's going to work. But at the very least, we can be very strong, very forceful, and very clear about the fact that Alaskans should have the jobs that they can do. And if we can't do the jobs, the next part of that equation is tell us why we can't do them, and we have the money to put into education process so that the next time around we have the ability to fill that job.
Wilkin, a 50-year-old businessman, is proud of his community service. He says he's running for office to make the state a better place to live. Guttenberg's a 45-year-old union laborer who served as the chairman of the state Democratic Party. He says that affiliation will help when it comes to negotiating with the governor. Both candidates for Senate seat O say they support education, resource development, and cutting the budget carefully. They're both interested in the dollar a pack tobacco duty, but oppose an income tax. And they're both socially moderate, though Guttenberg clearly backs spending state money to help people get abortions.
I'm completely pro-choice, and you have no right if it's not available to you.
Wilkin's stand is less concrete. He says the decision to have an abortion shouldn't involve the government, but that's where his certainty ends.
I don't know about public funding. I have a sense that there's probably enough private funding out there to take care of those women that have the need and have to have it taken care of. But at the same time, there may be those that simply don't have that ability, and we must take care of them as a society.
According to the candidates' campaign finance reports, Wilkins received more than $100,000. In the last month, the Wilkin campaigns attracted $12,000 from Anchorage business interests. Republicans also threw him $8,000. Guttenberg's raised just under $70,000. His major contributions last month came from statewide Democratic organizations who gave over $13,000. Union members also kicked in over $1,000. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
Teachers union organizer Claudia Douglas has waged a spirited campaign against incumbent Republican Al Veazey, attacking his legislative record on the tobacco tax, open meetings, and calling him close-minded. Veazey's hit back, offering his own prescriptions for fixing education, crime, and questioning her Fairbanks residency. This week, he released information insinuating Douglas has not been honest when applying for credit. Veazey says during the residency debate, a record search linked her name and Social Security number with other people.
We found records of reports that have Claudia's name on them and some of the various addresses that Claudia's used, along with other people's Social Security numbers. Now, I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but there is a problem out there in the records. And the people are involved need to look into those records and see what it takes to straighten it out.
Veazey characterized the release as helping Douglas get to the bottom of a mystery, saying she might be the victim of fraud. The information came from what Veazey calls public information from credit agencies. And while he's not making any charges, Douglas calls this an invasion of privacy.
If someone has my credit rating and they have somehow received this under fraudulent methods, it's a felony. And we're going to get to the bottom of this. I mean, I have never applied for any kind of credit using any other Social Security number than my card.
Douglas says Veazey's campaigned on keeping government out of people's lives and calls him a hypocrite for releasing such information. She responded by releasing her credit reports, and says when combined with Veazey's past comments, like jokingly confusing the terms indigenous and indigent,
voters are ready for someone else.
If we look at the headlines in the last few years and Mr. Veazey's record and his voting record on various bills, some of the actions, some of the comments that he's made, I think that he's turned people off. And I think that people have been offended by his remarks, and I think that people are tired of that.
When it comes to fundraising, the candidates are running roughly even at $70,000 each. Douglas lists several hundred individuals have given as little as $10, many of whom, she says, just don't like Veazey. He counters, saying it's a badge of honor to know the teachers' union wants him out.
And these folks see me as a very strong opposition to their special interests and their ability to get into the state treasury at will. They would like very much to get rid of me, and so they're doing it through the electoral process. I think it is a compliment to my effectiveness.
Veazey's running for a third term. Last year, he was House Majority Leader, and he's announced plans this year that if reelected, he'd like to be Speaker of the House. He says he knows he's in a tough campaign that could go either way. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. When it comes to Alaskan arguments, wolf management's right up there with subsistence and drilling in Anwar. Ballot Measure 3 will ban same-day airborne wolf hunting. Currently, anyone holding a trapping license can shoot a wolf provided they're 100 yards away from an airplane. Reform advocates say that current regulations are just a smokescreen under which skilled pilots can chase a pack of wolves into an open area and drop off a well-armed rifleman who shoots the pack to pieces. Ed Davis is co-founder of Alaskans for Fair Chase, a group that has worked with the Wolf Management Reform Coalition.
I think that we need to close some loopholes in the statutes and quit providing the cover that they use. And that cover is that they operate under the so-called land, walk, and shoot trapping regulation.
Davis and others argue that the current prohibitions are unenforceable and that wolf control advocates have for too long had the ear of the Board of Game and legislature. They say the ballot measure will help restore the tarnished image of Alaskan hunters who benefit from wolf control. But Alaska Outdoor Council Director Dick Bishop says managing game populations to benefit humans, even if that means killing wolves, is an acceptable practice. And while unpleasant, it's economically and environmentally more sound than most forms of agriculture that put meat on the table.
What it comes down to is the idea of implementing the environmental concept of think globally, act locally in a very practical Alaskan way to produce food for people. And it's pretty obvious that a lot of Alaskans value that.
Bishop complains that reform advocates have distorted the issue. Their television ads purport to show the unfairness of aerial hunting. In fact, the video documents the struggle of a drugged wolf darted by biologists in a helicopter.
This thing from the get-go has been advertised as come join us and help ban aerial wolf hunting. And that's the way it was presented by the organizers to influential Anchorage supporters. That's the way petition gatherers presented it to the public. And they didn't tell them that aerial wolf hunting was already banned and that land and shoot was already banned.
Bishop argues the measure is a backdoor plan to end aerial control programs. Its language allows wolf control only in a biological emergency, where predators are causing an irreversible decline in prey. Conditions Bishop argues are so loose, lawyers will have a field day. In Fairbanks, only 2 of 20 candidates running for statewide office support the measure. Most oppose using ballot initiatives to direct game management. The state's largest labor union, the AFL-CIO, with some 50,000 members, is also opposed to management by initiative. And even the Alaska Federation of Natives has joined the Outdoor Council in opposition. But Davis says just as some people have made an end run around the board, the Reform Coalition is making a justified end run around the legislature.
You have to fight fire with fire. If one side is making end runs around the Board of Game and trying to force their hand by stacking the Board of Game and rejecting nominees to the Board of Game, we've got to use the political process to deal with that. We got to use politics to fight politics.
Supporters of the initiative include former Governor Jay Hammond, as well as former Game Board Chair Doug Pope, who is also co-chair of the Reform Coalition. Spending on the measure is lopsided by almost 10 to 1. A week ago, the coalition reported spending more than $110,000, some $25,000 of which was from two animal rights groups. Opponents had raised and spent about $12,000. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Kim Adelia Leff is the Community Service Director at the Fairbanks Office of Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance. Part of the federal funds will pay for her to train local police officers, public defenders, judges, teachers, and others.
The idea behind it is that since domestic violence is so pervasive in our communities and in society in general, that there are so many professionals and people perhaps who haven't known much about it, yet work directly with a lot of victims and perpetrators of abuse. So the more information, you know, the better off, the better you're going to feel, less frustrated perhaps when you have a greater understanding of the issues, the better able you're going to be able to help a victim and also abusers as well.
Leff says the training will discuss specifics about the law and prosecution, but there's not enough money to address basic information, like attitudes towards domestic violence and male and female roles in society.
I'm hoping to do a little bit of that just to get people to at least start to think about it and to question, because we have to do that. You mentioned being someone who is outside of the system in terms of working with victims, but it doesn't belong just to those of us who work in the field. It's everybody's responsibility to get involved with this issue, because it's so pervasive and so far-reaching. So everyone has to start thinking about their own attitudes and feelings, how they were raised, how they're raising their children, what kind of world they want to leave their children.
Leff says the legislation directs trainers to address 4 points: the definition and cycle of domestic violence, assessment of the danger of each situation, resources available to victims, and the safety afforded them and their families. Lori Huguenin, director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, will also train public safety employees. She says the legislation mandates that each new police officer receive 12 hours of training. It's paid for by the federal STOP project under the Violence Against Women Act. Huguenin says the training's been going on for a few months.
Training ties in with prevention, in that if we have each system, each facet of the system working with one another and appropriately intervening, then it reduces the chances that there's going to be continued violence. And so I see the training as a way of getting people to a place where they can appropriately intervene and respond. And when all the pieces work together, that will hopefully keep the violence from happening again.
In Fairbanks, local police officers just completed the first round of training. Deputy Chief of Police Ken Steinard says it's helped to clear up what's expected of them under the Domestic Violence Prevention Act.
One of the dramatic changes that's in the law is that if there is probable cause, it does mandate that the police officer arrest the primary offender. I think probably police departments across the state have probably been pretty close to this in the past, but nevertheless, I think you'll probably see a slight increase in arrest rates across the state of Alaska.
As awareness of domestic violence increases, Leff and other victim advocates hope it'll break the cycle of violence. Because if the system works and a battered woman can seek help and get it, a new cycle will begin. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
No, Carl Shepro explains, the Electoral College doesn't field a team in the Pac-10 football conference, and he has no idea whether it has a mascot. But when the political scientist is asked why the institution is called a college, he concedes it's a little confusing.
Well, that's a good question, actually. Yeah, they don't. We don't have any ball fields or no parades, no caps and gowns, no commencement, things like that. They're kind of a mysterious group.
Even diehard political buffs hem and haw when asked about the Electoral College. Shepro says each state gets as many electors as it has representatives in both houses of Congress. So Alaska, with 2 senators and 1 congressman, gets 3. Often, party bosses select electors, or they're chosen at party conventions. Come election day, Shepro says, whichever presidential candidate gets the most votes, even if it's less than 50%, that's a situation called a plurality, that candidate will snag all 3 electoral votes. Well, possibly.
It would be conceivable in Alaska that Dole wins the plurality of the vote. And the three electors then for the Republican candidate would cast their ballot, and you know, given the politics within the Republican Party, it's very possible that one of those electors could be a Pat Buchanan supporter.
Shipro says the electoral system can give a winning candidate a sense of a mandate. In the Nixon-Kennedy contest, Kennedy narrowly edged out Nixon in the popular vote, but received a landslide in the Electoral College. In fact, says Daniel Ponder, a political scientist at the University of Colorado, there have been three times in our past when the popular vote went one way and the electoral vote went another. He points to the 1876 election when Rutherford B. Hayes lost the popular vote but went on to the White House thanks to the Electoral College.
The reason for that is usually that the Electoral College, all the Electoral College votes usually goes to the person who gets the most votes in the state. Not a majority necessarily, but the most votes. And so if you're able to put together a coalition of states, it's very possible that you could, theoretically at least, that you could be trounced in the Electoral in the popular vote and win the Electoral College.
Ponder says this situation is often held up as a weakness by those who want to reform the college. But apart from a few changes, the system remains pretty much as our founding fathers intended, college name and all. They created the college, says Philip Henderson of Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., to set up a wall between the office of the president and the potential firestorm of mob rule.
I think they were attempting to balance direct democracy, which they had some mistrust of, with Republican government, which in their minds meant trying to distance electoral politics somewhat from the people. They wanted a combination between direct popular will and informed judgment.
Henderson says when there's a strong three-party race and no one candidate garners a clear majority in the Electoral College, the matter is then thrown into the House of Representatives, with each state getting only one vote. And with the House's sometimes vigorous debates, people might confuse it with a post-bowl game brawl, but never with an institution of higher learning. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Most of them couldn't care less. They're not affected, you know, except in perceptions. But to the hunters, to the people who depend on wildlife for food or for their furs, you're darn right it's going to come back to bite them. And it's going to affect both urban and rural people. There's just no question about it.
Three, two, one. Now that the excitement of the election's over, Fairbanks voters will see a lot of familiar faces. The only new one to the bunch is Gary Wilkin, who won his race for Senate seat O to join the Republican majority that swept the state. Wilkin garnered 56% of the vote to claim victory. He says his next job is to get a meaningful position in the Senate organization to protect Fairbanks' interests.
The Fairbanks contingent will be together. Mike Miller is going to get elected tonight. Bert Sharp has proven himself to be a leader, a good senator. The three of us will be in lockstep with one another. We have to be that way. We've got some folks we got to stand up to in Anchorage, and we will. We think alike. I think we have many of the same priorities, and we'll be a team.
Wilkin takes over the seat from Republican Steve Frank, who chose not to run for re-election. Wilkin says he's hoping to follow Frank's place and sit on the Finance Committee as well. Democratic challenger David Guttenberg says he's glad the two candidates ran positive, issue-oriented campaigns, but he was unable to overcome the influence that Frank gave to Wilkin's campaign.
I thought I could take this district by making my point and my positions clear and strong, which is how I try to present myself anyway, and that would take care of it. It was still a long road to haul, even amongst people that should have been supporting me, thinking that, well, Gary's, Steve's guy, and that was always a problem.
Over on the House side, Democrats John Davies and Tom Brice fended off challenges from Bonnie Williams and Bob Boko to remain the only Fairbanks Democrats in Juneau. Democrat challengers suffered from weak showings, except in House District 32, where Claudia Douglas lost to Al Vizi by just 55 votes, in a district that Vizi designed when he was chairman of the reapportionment committee. Speaking with 80% of the precincts in, Vizi predicted an easier win than voters ultimately awarded.
I feel real good about the race. I felt we ran a real good campaign, stayed in touch with the voters, and if I was to take a guess, I would predict that I would win by 11 points. That doesn't mean anything. My guess isn't any better than yours. You know, in the past, I've won with 54% of the vote. I've won with 56% of the vote. Probably do somewhere in that area again.
With the rest of the votes in, the margin was only 1.5%. And while Douglas stopped short of conceding the race, she says she hopes Vizi will take the vote as a warning.
One of the things that this vote shows is that there are a lot of people that aren't happy with the performance, or at least we're hoping for a change. And if it ends up that Mr. Vizi does win this election, I think he needs to listen to some of us and to maybe reach out to those voters that that feel disenfranchised.
With so few votes between them, Douglas plans to ask for a recount. She says her campaign suffered under Vizi's attacks against her leadership of the teachers' union. The race also suffered from the area's lowest turnout at roughly 37%. Other districts polled in the mid-40s and better. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
With over 60% of votes counted in his favor early this morning, Gene Kubina of Valdez was inspired by his imminent victory. He called it a vote of confidence for the work he's proven he can do for the diverse District 35, which reaches north to Delta and south to Cordova. Kubina also credits his win to his staying positive during the campaign.
I made sure that all of my TV, my radio, my newspaper, and my mailers all dealt with me and what I was doing. And at the end, my opponent dealt a little bit on the negative side. And it was hard, actually, for me to fight that off, especially when at the beginning he started off with his, the voter pamphlet, and it was a negative towards me. And so I just made a decision, though, that I was going to do the best I could at staying positive and talking about me and what I've done and what I was going to do. And I think the people rewarded me for doing so.
Kubina says he'll continue to work toward the realization of the Trans-Alaska Gas Line, for which he pushed through a resolution in the legislature last session. He also has his sights set on exploring alternatives to the Sutton-Glen Allen intertie as a means to cheaper electricity for much of the region and developing a viable use for the closing Harbor View Developmental Center in Valdez. Kubina's opponent in the District 35 race, Republican Harley Olberg of Delta, admits Kubina sold himself better. As for himself, Olberg says he didn't do a good job of convincing voters of the significance of having a majority member in the House, and that the other issues he pursued, like moving the Capitol to the closing Fort Greeley and Delta, didn't reach the majority of voters who reside in the Prince William Sound communities, of what he refers to as a district biased by geography and population.
Issues are not the determining factor in the Valdez vote, in my opinion. I think that regardless of what you say or do, people from Valdez vote for people from Valdez.
Olberg says the extra time he spent in the district's biggest community, Valdez, didn't help his situation this time around. He only took 29% of the votes to Kubina's 70, a minimal increase from his 94 showing. Holberg says he's disappointed by the results but not surprised, and that he'll happily go back to farming again in the spring. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.